What I want to do today are two separate, unrelated, well, a little bit unrelated things. So here's the agenda. The first one is that I want to say a little bit about the parameters. So I want to explain, to the degree that I can, why one should explain the set of good parameters to have positive measure. Okay. So the big measure of good parameters. Being positive, and I want to explain this in 1D. The fact is that if you go to higher dimensions, this part is not very different. It follows quite closely the one-dimensional proof, so I like to explain this in one dimension. Can you see back here? It's okay. Okay. And then the second part is I want to explain how to check some of the conditions that I talked about the first day, namely the first one and the second one, okay, in some examples, in the kicked examples. So I just want to point out, you know, what the singular limit maps are, what, how do you prove that there's a Misarevich point, and so on. So these two parts of the talk are not entirely related, although you have heard, you know, how they kind of come together in some ways. So, the first part now. Okay. So here's the setting. Is I'm going to fix some. So F0 is a Misarevich map, okay, which I assume I don't have to define. Just assume that it has, for simplicity, that it has only a single critical point, and that this critical point in future time is trapped in some expanding Cantor set. In fact, for simplicity, let us assume that. Let us assume, for simplicity, that it actually goes, it gets mapped right away to a fixed point. The infinite. No, it can be. It has to be trapped in a Cantor set or in a set that stays away from the critical set. Okay, so it's trapped in an expanding set, and the picture is really identical if you do it for a fixed point. Nah, just allow me to say it. Wouldn't make any difference in what I say. You like it? I'll make. I'll still take one. It wouldn't make it just to keep you happy. Okay, so F0 of P is equal to P, and F0 prime of P. Okay, so in two steps, it goes to a fixed point, and it's an expanding fixed point. So for simplicity, let us assume that. And now I'm going to look at this is a one-parameter family, okay, and satisfying C3, the third condition that I wrote down the first day, which I will remind you of. This is the parameter transversality condition. So what this says is that if you look at DDA, F2A of C of A, okay, so you look at, as you change parameters, the critical point moves, okay, and so you continue to recognize it as a critical point, and you look at the second iterate, and you look at how that changes, okay, and that is not equal to DDA, P of A. This is the continuation, this is the smooth continuation of the fixed point, which you, of course, continue to recognize, and these two things, which coincided at A equals to 0, is now not moving at different speeds, okay, at. Okay, so I only need this at one point. At the Misarevich point, these two objects are moving at two different speeds. That's the one what I'm going to assume. And the claim is that from this, one could deduce that the Lebesgue measure set of the set of good parameters okay, and the good parameters are defined to satisfy two conditions. These are the Colle-Ekman and the Benedict-Carlson conditions. that this has a positive measure. And I will remind you of what G1 and G2 are. G1 is that Fn prime. The derivative along the critical orbit is growing exponentially. And G2 is that the critical orbit does not come back close to itself too quickly. So I really should put down some constant in front. But for all n. So I'd like to explain what I can about why this is true. Coming, if you take a Misarevich point, take a one-parameter family that satisfies this kind of transversality condition, why this should be true. And of course, I won't be able to explain it completely, but I'll say what I can. So the idea of the proof is one that is familiar to many of you, is that you think about, you identify, or you consider the duality, similarity, however you call it, between phase space dynamics. Okay. And I will explain what this means. Okay. Is that means there is some kind of a close relation between the two to parameter space dynamics. So what exactly do I mean by phase space dynamics? So here I fix a map. I fix one of these maps. And if you like, you can also fix a point in either interval or circle, the one-dimensional space. All of this is in one dimension now, right? And phase space dynamics means that you will then iterate the map and apply it to the point. Okay? And you get an orbit. Okay? Or equivalently, if you like, you can take an interval in your phase space, and then you can look at Fij. Okay. So you see an interval that goes to another interval that goes to another interval. You watch this interval move. Okay. And by parameter space dynamics, okay, I mean the following. Okay. So let me assume for simplicity, you can change coordinates a little bit and make C the fixed point for the whole family. So the whole family fixes, C is the critical point for the whole family. And if you do that, then you can fix A. Okay, and look at the function gamma I of A. So you fix one A at a time. This is defined to be F A I of C. So you look at the orbit of the critical point for the map A. And if alternately, you can think of this as an interval in A space. It's an interval in parameter space, and then you can look at gamma I of omega, I equals 0, 1, 2, and so on. And this family of this sequence of intervals would again be something like this. Okay, and this is happening in phase space. Right? This is in I. Okay. Both of these. Need more muscle. Okay. So both of these pictures are happening in I. One is really a dynamical system. You fix an interval and you iterate the dynamics. This one, I put quotation on the dynamics because it's really not a mapping of the space into itself. It's really looking at an interval of critical orbits. Okay. This is familiar to all of you in holomorphic dynamics. And this is certainly not my idea. I did not give any attributions because I don't know who to attribute it to. Maybe some of you in the audience would know where this came up first. I don't. Okay, so the idea of the proof is that whatever happens here, there's a close correspondence between the two, and in this case, it's particularly easy to see, so I want to draw you the picture to convince you that this is the case. Okay, so now, the claim here is about this. It's about the set of A's that have some good properties. So I'm going to prove the wrong result. I'm going to first prove a result for this. Okay? And then say, via this correspondence, I'm going to translate it over there. Okay? So that is the... So I'm deliberately proving the wrong lemma now. Okay? So suppose that F is a map near F0, okay, and it satisfies G1, G2, up to time alpha n. Okay? So remember these two time scales. If you want to talk about the dynamics up to time n, you need the critical orbits to be well behaved up to time alpha n. So I'm going to talk about dynamics up to time n. So the critical orbit is good up to time alpha n when alpha is a small number. So now I take J as an interval. Okay. J is an interval, it has to have some property, okay, which I'm going to fill in later. Okay. You will see the moment I write it out that you need something. Okay. So then the conclusion is that the Lebesgue measure of the set of X in J such that G1 prime, G2 prime hold up to n. Well, up to n is always positive, right? Let's say okay, up to n is of the form the amount of measures that you have to delete. These are the bad ones. This is the measure deleted. This is where something fails. Okay. Yes, I'm going to say what they are. G1 prime and G2 prime are the properties for corresponding to those two, but for phase space dynamics. Okay, for an X. Okay, so the set of X is violated before time n. Okay, so the set of bad parameters, the part that you have to delete before time n is like this. It starts someplace. Okay, don't know what that is, up to n, is of this kind, where epsilon is a number which is quite small. Okay. Epsilon is a number which is smaller than alpha. So now let me be lazy and not write down what G1 prime is. X is supposed to satisfy G1 prime if it... along the orbit is Lyapunov exponent expands like so, and it doesn't come close to the critical point faster than this. It's the same as G1 and G2, but for the point X using a single map. Okay. So as you could see, if I'm literally proving the wrong result, I'm claiming something on this side and I'm proving the corresponding result for that side. So here's the idea of the proof. I cannot give you the whole proof, but I'll say what I can. So the idea of proof is like this. First, if you look at this is time. Oh, maybe I should say first what the context is. So first, let's look at an X. So suppose that G1 prime and G2 prime hold for X up to time K, for all iterates up to time K. Okay. Now if you look at, this is the time axis. If you look at its derivative, remember this picture where, let's say that at first it's outside, and then at some point it comes near C. And then it's going to start to follow the orbit of C, follows critical orbit. And then it's, when it finishes following it, and then it stays outside for a bit, and then it comes near C again, and then it follows again. And so on. And this is the picture of what is happening to such an orbit up to time k, up to just before time k. And remember that during this period, when it's outside, we assume that it's growing roughly like e to the lambda. Okay. And when it's in these periods, well, at least at the end of the period, it has recovered. Okay. At the end of this period, what you get is e half lambda p. Okay. So it's always growing. Okay. And if it satisfies, now, in general, such an orbit need not be growing, because it, even though it's okay at the end, it could be that it makes a very, very close return, and then suddenly the derivative would drop very drastically. Well, it doesn't happen for this orbit, because it doesn't come too close too quickly. So it could drop, but only by e to the alpha n. So this really is a genuinely expanding map. At no point is it really contracting. Okay? So the fact that it's the fact that well, maybe I shouldn't assume this, huh? Let me not bother with this. Okay, I only need this. Okay. So suppose it doesn't come. It doesn't make returns that are too close. Then you will see that it's actually really expanding. Now, if this is the case for the up to time k, then what you can see is that fk, g2 prime always, these are, g2 prime, thank you. It doesn't come close, yes. Okay, so the critical orbit is good. But for x, I only assume that it doesn't come too close. So it does all the right things. It's outside and it's expanding. It takes a dip, but not too bad. And then it expands, it recovers, and takes another dip, not too bad, expands, and so on. So then I know that, suppose you have an interval of such x's, okay? Then what happens, so suppose this is not just for one point, but for a whole interval, then fk, okay, restricted to interval of such axis, okay, would be an expanding map. Okay, so this follows from what I said. There's a couple more things that you have to prove, is that they actually, most of the time, they have long images, right? Meaning that you don't get folded too frequently. So the things are getting expanded, but it's also folded. So each branch could, in principle, be very short, but you have to argue that actually it's not so short. The images are quite long. And then you also have to prove that there's distortion, which is guaranteed by the fact that you have good distortion here, and you have good distortion here, and so on. Okay? So all of these things together says that the image of such an interval is a pretty long piece, long straight piece. And if you have such a piece and you are going to cut out at time k a fraction, so the fraction deleted, is about e to the minus alpha k. Because at time k, it's e to the minus alpha k. So at time k, you delete e to the minus alpha k. So that means that if you look at the whole thing deleted, just on account of violating this coming too close condition, it's, in other words, violating g2, right? Fraction deleted at time k on account of G2 prime is e to the minus alpha k. Okay? So you delete something for coming too close. And that's that. And so if this was the only deletion that you make, then you can see that the total amount deleted is like that. Okay. With epsilon equal to alpha. Okay. And that, of course, is a finite amount. Okay. Now, but such a sum, since alpha is a small number, such a sum could be huge. So you better start summing from very late. So you want to make sure that nothing happens the first n zero iterates. For example, you could take an interval, and before you know it, the whole interval is lost. That's, assume that doesn't happen. If the interval doesn't get swallowed, then it will go on and behave like that. Okay. So that's the first part of the proof that I can explain. Now the second part is that I still have to look at deletion on account of G1 prime. Okay. And that one I cannot explain so well, but I can at least say this much. So if you look at if I look at the derivative of fk at x up there, if you do a very conservative estimate, you will say, okay, sometimes it's e to the lambda, sometimes it's half of that, so I can guarantee that it's e half lambda k. Okay. Well, that's not e to the lambda k. Okay. It's half. Okay. It's only half. Okay. And so that's not good enough. Another deletion is needed. Okay. So, but the way this is done is that it's via a large deviation estimate. Okay. It's via a large deviation estimate that says that, well, if you do things right, this is really the worst case scenario. It's assuming that you're doing exactly the worst things possible. That on average, things are not so bad. And in fact, you could have lambda. Okay? So for a large fraction of x, okay, it's actually okay. Okay. It's actually e to the lambda k. Okay. But where does this come from? Well, there's a little bit of manipulation behind the scene. What you actually do is that you choose lambda to be a little bit different. You assume that actually when you are away from C, the expansion is not really e to the lambda k, but e to the lambda 0. Okay. So in other words, when you are away, it's actually bigger. Okay. Together with the fact that you are away most of the time. On average. Okay. This is not something that's happening every step, but if you take something on average, if you look at a long enough orbit, then on average, if you arrange to, when it's outside, it's actually a little bit bigger than my lambda, plus it actually spends most of the time outside, then you will be able to get lambda back. So this is like a 3-page proof that I cannot explain here. So with these two together, so you do another deletion. This is only good for, well, large deviation means that it's only, that there's still a part that deviates from the norm by quite a bit, all right? So you delete that part, and that gives you this epsilon, which is going to be a little bit worse than the alpha. So epsilon is not good. If alpha is small to start with, epsilon is even smaller. Okay? This can be made quite small, actually, if you like. But, okay, so this is kind of the idea of the proof for this lemma. So I have explained to some to the degree that I can why the thing that I wanted to prove is true, but for the wrong space, okay? for the wrong kind of dynamics. So now let me connect those two. I can erase this. No. Okay, so now I start to talk about the relation between phase space and parameter space dynamics. Okay. So for this, I want to consider the map, two-dimensional map, capital F, and, well, okay. I'm going to look at this two-dimensional map, given with both parameter and phase space built into it. Now, via a change of coordinates, I may assume the following. Okay, so this you can make a change of coordinates for the whole family, and I can assume two things, that that the C is the critical point for all A. So in other words, it's always the same point, that's the critical point, and I can assume that P is a fixed point for all A. So now let me, C3 then becomes the following. C3 then becomes d dA f A square of C. Is not equal to d dA of how the P is changing, but P, the fixed point, is not changing. So okay. So let's look at what this map looks like. So this is A, this is X. So let's say this is the little parameter interval that I'm interested in. So okay. And let's say this is C and this is P. Okay. So I'm going to draw in gamma 0. Gamma 0 is, I'm going to, the graph of gamma 0 is this one. So each gamma can be seen as a graph, as a mapping from A to X. So this is the graph of gamma 0. Okay. And gamma 1, I don't know what happens, but gamma 2, dd that is not equal to 0. Like so. Okay. So what is the dynamics of this map? Well, this map is really just looking at all the whole family together. So it preserves each line. So it doesn't. If you restrict it to 1A, it's really just a one-dimensional map. It's moving up and down. But I'm just looking at all of it together. Okay. So as I iterate this map, what will happen? So this is a map from two dimension to two dimension, and I can iterate it. Okay. So as I iterate this map, what happens to gamma 2, gamma 3, gamma 4? Well, P is a fixed point for everybody, and it's an expanding fixed point. So what happens is that, let me not draw it this way, because you won't be able to see anything. Let me just take this picture and blow it up. Okay, I'm going to blow it up. It's really, really fat like that now. Okay, so this was gamma 2. But this is a fixed point, and it's getting stretched. So gamma 3 is going to go like so. Each one gets longer, right? And then eventually it will get very long. When it gets too long and starts to cross the critical point, I'm going to break it and destroy the parameters that come too close. And so I will always delete parameters where the graph hits C. And so I have to look at a smaller parameter set, but so here's the observation. If on some sub-interval of the original parameter interval, okay, dDA of gamma I, okay, is very big, so the graph has very, very steep slope, then right where you know where I mean, FA prime is approximately given by dDA gamma I plus 1 divided by dDA. Okay. And the picture is like this. Now, I'm going to draw it a little bit fatter, but you know that it's actually, this is very, very thin. So this is my omega prime, and here's the graph of gamma I. Okay. Think of this as very, very steep. Okay. What is F prime A? Well, I didn't say where, but I'm talking about a point roughly here. Okay. What is F prime A? F prime A is really the derivative of this two-dimensional map in this direction. Okay. What is this guy? Well, this one will have an image someplace, and it's really the derivative in this direction. Okay. So if the graph of gamma I is extremely steep, and so this is a very, very narrow strip, and you're looking at the derivative here versus here, they are almost the same. Okay. So this tells you that iterating F is almost the same as looking at iterating these curves. So let me erase this picture and draw another one that's maybe. One easy way to deal with that is to relate it to the distortion. It can come from the distortion of the FA. Okay, these guys are, this is going to get exponentially steep. If the map expands, it keeps making it steeper and steeper. So if FA prime is growing exponentially, then this becomes exponentially close to this. And you can actually get distortion estimates for gamma I from the distortion of dynamics, from the dynamics part. Okay. So the picture looks like this. Okay. Okay. You should think of this as extremely close and it's extremely steep, but I'm not really drawing it like that because I cannot. So here's an interval. Okay. And under FA, okay, it goes to another interval, which is expanded. Okay. And then under FA, again, it goes to another interval, okay, which is expanded. Well, here you have something like this, okay, but it's actually very much parallel now. I cannot draw it. Okay. And, well, it goes to something more or less like this, and it goes to something more or less like that. Okay. When this is so tight, these two are almost the same. You really cannot tell them apart. Moreover, they come exponentially close. And every time it crosses this the critical point, then you have to break up. You delete the things that fall into the critical point, and then you look at a smaller interval and start over again. So you can see why the dynamics of the two are very much comparable. And from this, now you take the proof that I've erased, and you say it again, not for these guys, but for those guys. QED. Okay. So the dynamics lemma now can be translated over to the lemma on parameter space. And that is roughly how one way to see it. Okay. It's because if you look at dynamic space, the set of x's that come too close to the critical point, which is the set being deleted is an exponentially small set. So if you look dynamically, of course, it doesn't come near there too often. There is statistics and so on. So you can understand the dynamics fairly well on dynamic space. We understand dynamic space better than parameter space, as usual, right? And then via this picture, you can see that you're really talking about this guy versus this guy. And when it's very, very, and they get exponentially close. So that's the end of part one. So the second thing that I wanted to explain is how to check these conditions in some of the kicked examples. Okay. So let me quickly remind you of what these two conditions are. Oh, maybe I should say the following, that I've explained to you how it works in one dimension, in n dimensions, with four rank one attractors. The proof it goes in more or less the same direction. Everything is tracked by these one-dimensional guys. Okay, but what you need to do is to follow the geometry more carefully, so that you have to watch the whole geometry deform as you change parameters, which is a little bit harder than watching an interval map deform. Okay? But other than that, it's really the same. And the second thing that I meant to say is that I could advertise I have recently written an expository paper on one-dimensional part. If you would like a copy of it, please feel free to write to me. It's expository, it's not new, and it's the one-dimensional dynamics for multiple critical points written in a way that is exactly how you would do the n-dimensional problem. Okay? So if you read it, it's the one-dimensional. I mean, there are many ways to do the one-dimensional proofs. Okay? The way that I've written it is that it's completely parallel to the way one would do it in n-dimension. So you could kind of use it as a guide. And you can LSY at since. It'll be put up sometime on the web when I figure out how to do it. Okay, so the second part now. So let me first just shift gear altogether, forget about everything I said before this. And I will first remind you of what C1 and C2 are. So there's a set of conditions. So the story is like this, that first you have to check to see that the geometric condition is roughly compatible. And then there are some conditions that you have to check. And if these conditions hold, then you really have strange attractors. Right? So these are the first two of the conditions and the most important of them all. Okay? So the first condition is that you have to be able to somehow put your dynamical situation into the framework where you have, okay, let me just do it in two dimension today. So x and y, it goes to some other map, x, y, a. So there has to be two parameters, okay, plus something that's order b, something that's order b. This part can actually be any dimension. This is one dimension. Okay. So b is a small number. So basically, this is a one-dimensional object plus order b plus order b. Okay. And I don't particularly care what those things are. And so the singular limit maps that I do care about is the one that's fa of x equals f tilde x 0, y is equal to 0, a. Okay. So if that piece with y set equal to 0. So this is a one-parameter family of one-dimensional map, and that is a C1. And C2 is that if you look at this family, it passes through a Misarevich point. Okay. So, and there are a couple more conditions, but let's focus on just these two for today. Okay. So I want to explain how this works in the context of a limit cycle. So first, I'm going to think phi t is a flow, any flow, and gamma is a limit cycle. It's an attractive limit cycle. Hyperbolic limit cycle, I should say. And so this limit cycle has p as a period, and kappa is the kick map. Okay. So So now, on the face of it, I just have an ODE, which is a limit cycle, and it's and I'm kicking it. Think of the kick as a mapping from a neighborhood of the limit cycle to itself. Okay. So there is no. First thing I have to do is to put it into that context. How do I find my family of F A B? So in this case, A is going to be something between 0 and P, where P is the period. Okay. And B is going to be any sequence of Bn going to 0. It doesn't have to be defined for all P. B, it doesn't make sense, right? Any sequence going down. And FABn of FABn is really nothing more than kick followed by flow, you go n times around plus a. So this is FAB. Okay. So what you do is that P is the period, so you go n times around, and then you go a bit more at a. That's the family. And I claim that as B goes to 0, this converges, it has a singular limit, okay? So it has to be put into that form, okay? And everything inside there has to be C3, okay? Including the convergence to the singular limit has to be C3. So one way to see that this family converges, so I claim, this is not much of a claim, it's very easy to see, okay? Converges as n goes to infinity, as bn goes to 0, to FA0, okay, which I can name as something which I know Charles already knows. So this is the limit cycle. Okay. So the limit cycle goes this way. Okay, and it has a stable foliation. So if I take a point here, X, what is the map FABN? Is that you first kick it, so the kick sends it to here, okay, and then you go around n times, and then which lands you on, this is an invariant foliation, so n times around, and it lands you someplace down here, and then you go a bit more. A is somewhere between 0 and 1 full period, so you go kind of n plus something round. Well, if you look at such a map Bn goes to 0, you go around more and more times. So the net effect would be that you first come down here and then go. So if I call this map pi, okay, it would be you first come down here and then go phi a. Okay. So this FA0 is nothing more than kick, project along the foliation, travel, flow A. Okay. And if you make the flow C4, then you can control it and have this be a good convergence. Okay. So this is how I put the situation into that context. Okay. So what is the singular limit f little f a? Well, you just take a point on the cycle and then kick it up, slide down that stable foliation, and then slide for time a. Theorem, which is really a special case of the things that I mentioned the other day, is that if you, so suppose I look at the following equation. So this is about the simplest equation that one could have with a limit cycle. And here I have done it so that the limit cycle is that this is y direction and this is theta, and y equals to 0 is the limit cycle. Okay? And if you do that, suppose I now add a kick. My kick is a sine theta. With time t, okay. Then the conclusion is that if the number sigma over lambda times a, okay. So this is the number to pay attention to, sigma lambda. I assume that those are. Let's assume everything is positive. Times a is sufficiently large. The composite map f sub t, which is equal to kick, which is time t map, has a strange attractor with all the whole package of properties that I mentioned in the first talk for positive measure set of t. And this is not just a positive measure set, but a repeating positive measure set. Okay. But it has to be sufficiently large. Okay. This is definitely, you should think of it as a long relaxation. Okay. So how does this look in the So here, note that the slope of WF is the inverse of this number. Okay. Maybe I should say absolute value of slope. Okay, I don't know which way, but okay, it's lambda over a. Okay, so let's first think about this as having big slope. Okay, so if sigma over if sigma over lambda is small, okay, i.e. the slope is big, okay, the picture is like this. So in this very simple example, they are straight lines. Okay. So here's the limit cycle, and the foliation is like that, almost vertical. Okay. So now I take a little segment, let's say this one, okay, and I kick it so it becomes, let's say I kick it so that it becomes like this. Okay. So I look at the singular limit now. I look at FA, the singular limit map. So it takes this segment, it kicks it up there, and then I slide back down. And the image is exactly the same segment, where everything is just moved a little bit this way. Nothing is happening. This is not a good situation. You definitely want this to be big. Okay. But if this is if on the other hand, for sigma over lambda large, okay, and that means the slope is small. When the slope is small, that means that the foliation looks like so. Okay. And now again, I take a little segment and I kick it up to something like this. Well, I don't have to slide because they stay put. But this part gets slid all the way up to here, so the image. It's like that. So at least as far as the eyes can see, there is the tendency to stretch and fold, and it looks like a strange attractor may be present. So this is a situation that I would describe as, so I would describe this as geometrically compatible with having a rank one attractor. Because the singular limit map looks like it's taking a piece and really stretching and folding it. And so it doesn't say that there is a strange attractor for any t. You apply the theorem which says that, well, unless you are pretty unlucky, you will have one, and we're not unlucky here, so we have one. Okay, so I want to, now, this is easy to do because this is everything is linear, and I know the foliation, and it's exactly parallel. In general, even if you locate, you succeed in locating a limit cycle, say for an ODE or a PDE, you will not be able to find out what the situation, what the foliation is like. It's not so easy to find out exactly what a foliation is like, especially when it's a little bit away from the cycle where you will be kicking. So in general, it's not so easy to write down explicit conditions that will guarantee this. Except in the case of hop bifurcation, when all that information is contained in a single number. Okay? And that's why I singled that out as a special case that I want to say something about. Okay? So I want to finish with showing you how the things look for hop bifurcation. So this is a supercritical hop bifurcation, generic supercritical hop bifurcation. Okay, and so just to quickly remind you, so let me put this in normal form. Let's say this in two dimensions. It doesn't have to be two dimension, but let's say that it's in two dimension, and let's start from normal form. So you can write it as something like this. And the number of interest is this one, okay? And I'm going to write this as alpha. I'm only interested in when mu is equal to zero, so at the bifurcating point, and this number is alpha plus I beta. Okay? And the twist factor that I had identified last time is beta over alpha. It's the rotating part divided by the real part. So I want to show you how it shows up how this number shows up in those equations. So the way I get FAB is exactly the same. But first let me blow it up to standard size. Okay. So first, blow up cycle to standard size. Okay. When you do that, you will get an equation. I'm going to make it look exactly like that picture here, and it's an equation like this. This is a constant. This is the twist factor. Some higher order terms in theta and y. Okay. And this is exactly the picture where I have the cylinder picture. I've just blown it up to standard size. Okay, so this. Okay. Now, if you look at this picture, if you look at mu equals to zero, it's a very degenerate picture. You will get theta equals a constant and y equals zero. Okay. So here, I need that my lambda, the contraction, is not there at mu equals to zero, of course. That's the That's the point when it's still not, it's the bifurcating point. And the what I called shear, the number sigma that gives you the slope, is also not there, but the quotient is there. Okay. So the foliation, so at mu equals to zero, everything is very degenerate. There's no contraction and no shear, okay? But the foliation is robust as mu goes to zero. And the picture always is, it looks something like this. The foliation is like that. And this slope here is beta over alpha. It just follows from the equation. In the blow up. So this is a limit cycle that is this really tiny guy that's emerging, right? So I'm blowing it up to unit size, and I see a picture that's very, very stable. Okay. So now I just do exactly that to it, and I'll tell you what I get in the end. So now I add, kick, okay, and so on, and so on, and I tell you the singular limit. Except now I have one parameter family, so there's a parameter mu. So f a mu converges in C3 as mu goes to zero to f a, where f a is given by right over there, okay. It's of the form theta plus A. A is a translation. Okay. Oh, A is the FAB. Okay. This is the kick function. Function that's related to the kick. Okay. So what you see is that you see the twist factor and the kick function, assuming that it's radial. Okay. If it's not radial, then it's kind of the radial component that shows up there. Okay. So so that's the limit cycle, and it pretty much follows from that equation. Okay. So to check C2, then, I have to prove the following lemma. Okay. So it's not related to that situation, completely general. So the question is, why should I have a? Oh, so maybe I should draw a picture of that. Okay. Let me first draw a picture of this function phi. Okay. So here is this is a function of f zero. Okay, a equals zero. Okay. So if I just have theta, so a is equal to zero. So if I just have theta, it would be this map here. This is the graph of the map f zero. If that part wasn't there, okay, and I'm going to add something to it, okay. Well, this is the degree zero part of the thing that you add to it. So if the twist is small and this is only moderate, what you will be adding would be something like this. Okay. And nothing is going to happen if the twist is small, okay, or this function is not doing much, okay. If this part is big, if I'm going to take the view that this is fixed, then I'm going to tune this, all right? You can also take this to be fixed and tune that, and it amounts to the same thing. So if that is fixed and you're going to tune this, then when this number gets bigger, it will go more and more like so on. Okay. As I tune this number up, okay, if I increase this. So why should such a what do I do when I put A up? I take this whole graph and I just shift it up down. Okay. So the claim would be that for such a when this is big enough, that you will see for some A's you will find some Miserevich points. Okay. Now, the thing is that for the quadratic family, it's easy to have Misarevich points because the there's a Cantor set which moves very slowly as you increase the height of the parabola. The tip is always going to you will pass through lots of Misarevich points, right? Well, here every circle map has at least two critical points, and you have to somehow steer both of them in at the same time. Okay? So why is it that you can do that? Well, you always can. It's not so. Well, one possibility is take two parameter families, then you can steer both in easily. If you choose to stick with one parameter family, here's a little result that tells you that you will have Misarevich points also. So here's a little proposition, if you like, that says that if you consider a family A theta equals to theta plus A plus L phi, where this is a circle map where phi has where all of phi all the critical points of phi are non-degenerate. Then for all L bigger than some L0, if you make this one big enough, there exists the Misarevich points. Okay. My definition of Misarevich point has no negative Schwarzian in it, by the way. Okay. It's a 1 over dense. Okay. So you will always find lots of Misarevich points if you make this figure big. Another way of saying that you're going to multiply this by some huge thing. Okay? So why? Maybe it's fun to give an idea of proof of this just very quickly. Okay? The idea of proof is like that. Okay? You fix a Cantor set. Okay? So this is a Cantor set, invariant Cantor set, away from the critical point. For A equals 0. Okay? Now, as you now move A, then this set moves. Okay? But it moves very, very slowly. Let's say there are two critical points. Okay? So the critical point, so the fact that it's easy to see is that if you look at any critical set, look at any invariant set or periodic point, if you like, if you move the tips here higher and lower, the tips will move much faster than that Cantor set. So it's as though the Cantor set is staying put and the tips are kind of shooting past it. Okay? So let's say that the C1, C2 are the critical points. They move faster than FA of C1. The images of they move faster than this set. So now I think of the center Cantor set as stationary since the other one moves faster and you move through it. Okay. So then what do you see is that for each one, so for each of the critical points, for each I can define this set. This is the set of A such that FACI is in. So this is a set of parameters where the critical point, the first or the second critical point, gets trapped in this Cantor set. Okay. So what is this set like? What is this set? This set is like an imprint of the set of that one. Right? You imagine this one is staying fixed, and you move right through it. So what you've done is to have made a copy of this, an imprint of this set in parameter space. Okay? So this is a copy of gamma 0 in parameter space. So you have now two copies of the Cantor set in parameter space, and the question really is whether or not that's what you want. Once you have that, then you have a parameter that's good for both critical points. Well, if you think of these as zero measure set is not a very good, not likely that two zero measure sets will intersect. Okay. But they're not zero measure sets. What are these sets? They are sets, they are invariant, dynamically defined invariant sets. So these are Cantor sets that have geometric structure. They have geometrically, they have scale. Okay. And if the map is very expanding, so if FA is really expanding, okay, then it also, you can make them to be, Hausdorff dimension could be quite close to one. So now you have two Cantor sets that are geometrically, they have ratios, they have scales. And the Hausdorff dimension is very big. You put two of them together, they're going to hit. And so, end of proof. These are zero measure sets, but because they have structure, they have structure. They are dynamically defined. They have exactly the ratios of them. Okay? So if I exaggerate a bit, I would be taking real Cantor sets that are defined by that have ratios, right? Like you take the 9-10 Cantor set, two 9-10 Cantor sets, you put them together, they are going to hit. No, I don't know how to apply anything directly, so I do it from scratch. But I think this is in fact, I don't really prove it like this, but this is the idea behind it. There's a little bit of irregularity. It's not so uniform, right, because you do come quite close to the critical set and so on. So I have to do everything again. But it's the same idea. I'm sorry, I ran over.